Guy that David King or John. Whoever it is.
Santa Clarita. At her own expense. Our speaker will be Kathy W. Let's give her a round of applause.
Ooh, it's bright up here. Hi, everybody. My name is Kathy Watson, and I'm a grateful Al-Anon. Okay, thank you so much, David, for asking me to do that. He asked me this like 4, 5, 6 months ago at the Southern California fundraiser for the SoCal convention. And so it's like, really? You're going to ask me this far in advance? But thank you. I am honored to be here. And I've come to this meeting a couple of times. I don't come very often because I work out in El Segundo, and takes forever to get here. So I try to plan to work from home when I can to get here. But I'm really grateful to be here. Welcome to the newcomers. I hope that you keep coming back. I will tell you, I'm certainly not an expert in Al-Anon. I've just been somebody who's been affected by alcoholism, like the other people in these rooms. And so just keep coming back, and hopefully you'll hear something. You'll hear your story. I certainly did. It took me a while, though, because I came in here not wanting to be here. I came in here very, very angry and thinking it was everybody else's fault, and if they would just do it correctly, then I would be okay. And that's kind of the story of my life. It was like, if you would just do it this way, then everything would be okay. I've heard a lot of, you know, Al-Anon and AA stories where they start off saying, I never fit in, and I will tell you that is exactly my case. From the very, very get-go, I didn't feel like I fit in. I came to the United States probably like when I was born in the United States, but I came back I guess I was about 4 years old, and I didn't speak a lick of English. And so going to kindergarten, I recall that the kindergarten teacher wouldn't allow the other kids to play with me because we didn't understand each other. And so it was really, I just wanted to play. You know, recess, I just wanted to play. So even from way back then, I felt like I didn't fit in. And so my goal was to always fit in. And I carried that throughout my life. I can tell you that, so you're going to hear a little bit, and I'll try to keep it linear, but I can tell you already it's not going to. I'm going to jump around. you'll hear a lot about my relationships, because I will tell you the thing with me is, in hindsight and after working these steps and after being in Al-Anon, when I came here, I certainly didn't know this, but after being here, I found out that, I mean, every relationship that I had been in, I am one who has been in relationships with all people who are addicted to something else. And my reaction to people who are addicted to things that other than me is not good. I always wanted to be the center. You know, we hear also in Al-Anon that we have this need to be needed, and that's certainly the case with me. And so every relationship I was in, and I don't know why, but every single one I was in, they were always into something else other than me. It started out with me, but it didn't end with me. And, you know, my reaction to that was not good. You know, I did a lot of, I acted out a lot based on that, those kinds of relationships. And so I was always doing things to try to be the center and to try to fit in and try to be needed. And a lot of it was doing whatever I could for whoever I was with that they ought to be doing for themselves so that they would need me. You know, and I didn't know that I was doing that until I got into this program. So what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. So again, I was the one that tried to fit in. I was a really good chameleon. I moved around a lot, and wherever it was I moved, I could fit into whatever crowd I needed to fit in. And the scenario is I lived most of my life in Southern California. I was in Inland Empire for a while. And so what I did, like during the school year, is I had this very long hair, and I could put on my makeup, and I looked just like the Chicanos. I could fit in with the Mexican girls, you know, and I could speak, you know, with a little bit of an accent, and I could act the way I needed to act, and, you know. And so I fit in really well during the school year. Well, during the summer, I hung out with the surfers. And I fit in pretty well, except that I never had the blonde hair. I couldn't get the blonde hair. But I, you know, hitchhiking to the beach, I'm hanging out at the beach. My mother used to always call me a gypsy or a hippie or whatever. I mean, I had the really long hair, the great big old hoops and the holy jeans and whatever. So I could fit in with that crowd, you know, during the summer. And so that's what I did, is I just fit in wherever I needed to fit in. When I lived in California, again, I hung out usually with the Mexican crowd. And I will tell you, for me, you know, that whole thing about attention is what I was looking for. And so the relationships that I was in, you know, it was all about getting that attention. You know, it was all about doing whatever you needed to do to get that attention. And that's what I did. And I remember there were several times, I mean, when I got into Al-Anon, when they said, you know, some of our character defects are about, you know, we manipulate, we lie. And I'm thinking, there's no way. It's the alcoholic that does that. Well, going in hindsight and looking at some of the things that I did to get that attention, well, I manipulated, I lied. You know, I did a lot of different things to get that attention. And so that's kind of what I did, you know, growing up, looking for that attention. When I moved from California to Oklahoma for a little while. And so now I'm in a school. My stepfather was in the military, so I was in Fort Sill. And so now you have, instead of the Chicanos and the surfers, now you have the Indians and the white people, right? And so I have the long hair so I could fit in with the Indians. So now I'm going to powwows, learning a little bit of Kiowa here and there. And so again, I'm that chameleon. I could fit in wherever I need to fit in because I really just need to fit in. I need to be a part of, you know, not knowing that that's what I was doing. From there, I moved to Germany for a little while, and there, the school that I went to, it was predominantly black and white. You know, well, I couldn't, no matter what, become black. but I still did whatever I could to fit into whatever crowd that I was in. You know, I think that, you know, one of the things for me is I hung out with a lot of people who did a lot of drugs and they drank a lot. I didn't, because I drank, I fell asleep. It just didn't work for me. But I can certainly hang out. I loved hanging out with the people who did all of those things. Because for me, I was always a chicken. I was always very, no other way to put it, but probably just goody two-shoes. And I was the one that was in control, you know. And so I hung out a lot with the kids who did those things. And it was, when you do that, it's really easy to be needed. You know, because they need you to drive them home. They need you to, you know, lie to their parents. They need you to cover for whatever it is. I could do that because I wasn't inebriated or I wasn't, you know, using any drugs and alcohol. So anyways, that's how I grew up, just trying to fit in wherever it was I was trying to fit in. When I came back to the States, and I'll tell you, the way I got into this program, again, you know, in hindsight, I know that all those relationships were with people who drank or used alcohol. But when I came into this program, I thought the only alcoholic that I had ever known was the one that I was in the relationship with at the time. And he happened to be my husband. But I didn't know that that he was an alcoholic. What ended up happening was he and I were, when we were dating, there was that whole, it was very on again, off again, because again, he was addicted to something else other than me, and I didn't like that, you know. And so, you know, for 4 years we were in this relationship, and he would say things to me like, okay, well, you know, you can have Friday night or Saturday night, but you can't have both. And I'm like, well, wait a minute, we're dating. How come we can't be together both on Friday and Saturday? I don't understand that. What do you have to do? And so again, my manipulation would come in, and I figured out ways to make it so that we were together both Friday and Saturday night. The problem with that is that, and again, this is in hindsight that I realize, is that because I manipulated that, I knew deep inside that he really didn't want to be with me, and so we were miserable. I mean, I made the evening and the weekends miserable because I knew that he didn't really want to be with me. It was because I had manipulated the situation where he had to be with me. So again, it was on again, off again for about 4 years, and he used to say things to me like, well, you know, why are you so insecure? Why do you just need to be together? And I'm thinking, well, we're in a relationship. We're supposed to be together. You know, I don't understand why you want to go off with your friends. I didn't understand that at all. I'm thinking you're supposed to be addicted to me, not everything else. And, you know, because, again, I grew up with that mentality of attention is love, and if you're not paying attention to me, then you don't love me enough. And so, you know, he, again, it was that conversation of, well, why are you so insecure? And I'm like, well, you know, if we were living together, I wouldn't be so insecure. You know, it would be better, you know. So after 4 years of dating, we started living together. And he was still doing what he needed to do. And, you know, a few weeks later, we're fighting because he's not coming home. And I'm not getting the attention that I need. And I'm doing all the things that I thought. And this is, again, my brain that says this is how it's supposed to look, that I thought I was doing all the things that I was supposed to, and he's not coming home, or he's coming home really late. He's not inviting me to go with him, you know, and so it's on again, off again, you know, and we're fighting and we're fighting, and you know, and he's asking once again, what's wrong? Why is it that you are so insecure? You know, we're, you know, you said that if we were living together, everything would be okay. We're living together. I'm here, you know, just because I want to go off and do whatever. I don't understand what's going on. I said, well, you know, if we were married, I wouldn't be so insecure. You know, and that, again, is another story of my, it's like, you know, as soon as, or if only, or when this, then I'll be. You know, I was always waiting for that next thing to happen so that I would be okay. And, so we dated for 4 years, we lived together for 4 years, and then we finally got married. And nothing changed. He was still doing what he was doing, you know, after we had gotten married. I had this idea that everything was going to change, and now we're married, now he's going to pay attention to me, now he's going to come home, now this, and this, and that just wasn't happening. And shortly after we got married, you know, we're fighting, constantly fighting. I really did not have any clue that there was alcoholism in the house. I had absolutely no clue. I knew that there was something wrong, you know, and it talks about it and understanding ourselves. I thought, you know, if he just doesn't love me enough, you know, I'm not pretty enough. I'm not making the right meal. You know, there's just all of these things in my brain that says it's me. You know, and besides that, he's telling me it's me. So I'm thinking, it's me, you know, it's me, so what's wrong? And so what ended up happening that introduced me to Al-Anon was probably about a year after we were married, and our communication and alcoholism completely destroys communication, at least it did in my life. And what ended up happening is our communication pretty much went like this. I would come home. No, he would come home because I was always home. I was always home waiting for him to get home. You know, so I was home. He would come home, and I'd be waiting with hand on hip. and you know, the words out of my mouth was, we need to talk. And his response would be, now what? And I would say, well, I'm really angry, and I'm really upset. And his response would be, and so what else is new? And that was it. We did not talk. You know, there was, the classic things that happen in alcoholic homes, that the communication was just absolutely non-existent. And it was just, you know, me just waiting, for I don't know what, whether, you know, when he came home, for him to come home for my life to start. Well, he would come home and he'd be passed out. or lock himself in his room or whatever. You know, he had this one room that we called it a stereo room. Now I know it was his using room. But he would come home and he'd just go straight into that room and close the door and I wouldn't see him. And, you know, so I would wait for him to come home for my life to start, and he'd come home and my life still didn't start, you know. And so, anyways, the way I found out about alcoholism and the way I found out about the things that were going on was that he wrote me a letter because we weren't talking to each other. And he wrote me a letter and he left it in my car. And I found the letter on my way to work. And basically it said that he thinks he had a problem with alcohol and that he needed help. And that was such a relief to me. And I'm thinking, great, now we know what the problem is. Let's go get it fixed. And so I came home and I said, okay, let's do this thing. Here's the Yellow Pages. Figure out where you need to go. Because this was when Schick was on TV a lot. You know, and I said, okay, here, figure out where you want to go. We'll get it taken care of. I'll take you over there. We'll get this thing done. And I had no clue because I really didn't know about alcoholism. I will tell you that, you know, I didn't grow up in an alcoholic home, but my family, my mother was affected by alcoholism. I didn't know that until after I got here. My father, my real father, drank so much that every time my mother would, ask me, have you seen your father? Is he still drinking? Well, I didn't have a clue why she kept asking me that. It was like a light bulb that went on after I'd been here for a while. So there was a lot of effects of alcoholism without me ever even realizing it. And so anyways, I can tell you today that the reason why my husband told me about his problem with alcohol is because he had gotten suspended from work. And it wasn't one of those 3-day suspension, it was a 30-day suspension. And so he felt like he really needed to tell me something because he had no money coming into the house. And so, so I'm thinking, this is great, this is perfect, let's just, you know, drive you off to the treatment center, get you fixed up. And so I waited for him to select the place, and I waited, and I waited, and he didn't select the place, so I picked one for him. And it was not too far from my house, and so, you know, I made the phone calls, I did whatever I needed to do, and I got him to that treatment center. And one of the things that they told me when I called and said, okay, I'm going to be dropping him off today, and my thought was I'm going to be dropping him off today, and I'll, you know, pick him up when you're done with him. They said to me, well, you need to come in because you have to sign the paperwork. You know, he's coming in on your insurance, so you need to come in and sign the paperwork. And I said, okay. So I walked in there, and I will tell you, it was like I had so much shame. And I didn't even realize that that's what was going on until I was walking down the halls of that hospital, and I'm thinking, everybody's looking at me. They're looking at me thinking, oh, my God, he didn't love her enough. You know, she couldn't do it. You know, she couldn't get him to stop. And that's all I felt was, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God. And so so I just felt full of shame. And I signed off the paperwork, you know, for the insurance and so forth. And the doctor and the nurse told me, you know, this is really a family disease, and you should get some help for yourself. And we have a program. We would like you to come back and attend some of our group sessions. I was so filled with shame. And so all I could do was just cry, cry, cry. And the nurse said, here, I'm going to give you an address. I'm going to send you to an Al-Anon meeting tonight. And so she gave me the address of a place, and I'm pretty good with following direction because I really don't like authority figures too much. And so I went to that Al-Anon meeting, and I'll tell you, it scared the bejesus out of me. Because I walked in there. What I was really grateful for was like a candlelight meeting, so it was really dark. That was good. but it was a large meeting, and they talked about things that I was always told you do not talk about, you know, and it scared me. And I could hear my mother's voice in one ear saying, what will the neighbors think? You don't tell anybody about that stuff. And then in the other ear, I could hear my husband saying, what goes on between us is between us. You don't tell your friends what's going on, you know. And so I'm just sitting there in this meeting thinking, no way, I can't do this. You know, I can't talk about this stuff. Why are these people telling people this stuff? How embarrassing. And so I will tell you, I never went back to that particular meeting again. But it was So the other thing is, you know, with my husband telling me, you know, don't tell your friends, I can tell you that by that point, I had no friends. I had given up everything because I needed to get home. Again, I told you I spent a lot of time waiting, but I needed to get home right after work to wait. Okay, and you know, at one time I had friends who would say, you know, let's go to the movies or let's go to Knott's Berry Farm or let's go. And my response was, oh no, I have to go wash the windows. Oh no, I got to go mop the floor. Or no, I got to go, you know, whatever it is, I got to get home. You know, and that's what I did was I waited and I waited and I waited. So my husband got into that program and he. His story is he went in and out, and my story is I went in and out, and I went in and out, because every time he went out, I'm thinking, why do I need to come? You know, it is still his problem. And the changing point for me was that at one point, my husband actually did get sober for a period of time, and he was doing really well. And he was doing all the things that I had told one of the counselors at that treatment center, that if he does all of these things, everything's going to be great. I'll be really happy. Because remember, if you do it my way, I'm going to be really happy. And my way was go to work, bring home the check without cashing it, you know, go to your meetings, go do the things that you're supposed to do in this program, and pay attention to me, you know. And so he was doing all of those things. And the turning point for me was that he was singing in the shower. My husband's just a really pretty happy-go-lucky guy, and he's singing in the shower, and I am just pissed. Because I'm sitting here listening to him thinking he has no right to be happy. After all the crap that he's put me through, and I will tell you, when he was in that treatment center, I had an awakening, because there was a lot of stuff that I was... The part of it was just completely, totally my denial of not wanting to see all the things that was going on. But the other part was he hid it very well. He worked shifts, and so he'd get home before me, and he could hide the mail, and he could erase all the recordings of all the people calling saying, your bills are overdue, you know, and hiding all the pink slips and mortgage notices and all that stuff. And so when he was in that treatment center, I got the mail, I got the voice messages, and I got pissed. You know, I got to, that was the point where I became, and we talk about don't be a doormat, and I was a doormat. I became the bulldozer. From that point on, when I found out all the stuff that was going on, I got up off that floor and I became the bulldozer. And that's kind of my story too, as I go from this end of the pendulum all the way to this end, and I'm still... You know, still trying to find that middle a little bit. Let's see. So I got pissed because he was happy. I didn't think he had a right to be happy, which changed my. What ended up happening when I realized how angry I was getting, I also recalled some of the words I heard in Al-Anon, which were things like, "Happiness is an inside job. You can choose to be happy." You know, it's a choice. You can make the choice to be happy. You can start your day over at any time. You don't have to wait till morning. Those kinds of things that I heard in the meetings, and I'm thinking, oh my God, there must really be something wrong with me because I can't even be happy that he's happy. I don't think he ought to be. I want to make him really miserable because I was miserable. I am not one to suffer alone. So what ended up happening is I started going to meetings with a different attitude, a little bit of a different attitude, with a little bit more of an open mind, and trying to listen for the similarities now instead of all the differences and why I didn't need to be there. I mean, I was too busy, don't you know, waiting for him. And so I started going with a little bit of a different attitude, and I'm so grateful for that because, you know, there was something in me that knew that this wasn't lasting, and it wasn't. I mean, I remember going to the meeting saying, you know what, I don't know whether my husband's going to go back out there or not, but this time I don't want to go out with him. You know, if he's going to circle the drain, I don't want to circle the drain with him. I just can't do it again because we'd been in and out several times. And I just didn't have the energy to do that anymore. I didn't want to do that anymore. And so I started going to Al-Anon for a different reason, and I'm really, really grateful. I got some service positions, not because I wanted to, but because people volunteered me, but I got into some service positions. And, you know, they talked about that earlier about, you know, it's a great deal to take service positions because it'll keep you coming back when you don't want to. And there were plenty of times when I didn't want to because he did come home, or I didn't want to because he didn't come home. I mean, I could make up any reason, and I didn't want to go to the meeting, but I kept going because I had a commitment at those meetings. So anyways, I did start going with a little bit of a different attitude and a more open mind, and I finally got a sponsor. And I will tell you, the first sponsor that I got, I was really... One of the reasons why I'd asked her, what I related to in her story, was that she talked about never saying hello to anybody first. And that was absolutely my story. I was so afraid of people, and I was so afraid of rejection, that I would never say hello to you first. You had to say hello to me first, and then I would respond, because I was so afraid of being rejected. And so she became my first sponsor, and she helped me out a lot as far as, you know, trying to get me some of the basics, because, you know, my attitude, and again, I came into the rooms thinking, if I look good enough, then everything's okay. And the problem with that is that I believed it. I believed that if I looked good, I was okay. And I just kept stuffing those inside feelings. And I'm one of those, I'm more of a logic kind of based person. You know, I do A plus B equals C. Forget the feelings, you know, other than anger. I can do anger really well. But, you know, so I don't do the feelings very well. And so she got me really started with the basics, with things like gratitude. I'm like, gratitude? What do you mean gratitude? I don't understand gratitude. You know, because I came in more with a sense of entitlement. I'm thinking, I worked for that. I'm entitled to that. I don't understand why I need to be grateful for that. And so she got me started with some basics with gratitude. And, you know, some of it was as little as, well, why can't you be grateful that he was sober for one day? I'm like, well, because I want more. You know, I don't know how to be grateful for what I have. I always want more. I always want something different. And so she started me with some of those basics. And I'm really grateful for her for that. But I will tell you that, you know, my first experience with a sponsor is that I didn't... I tended to call her after the crisis instead of before or during. Because, again, I'm people-pleasing. I want to fit in. I want to show her how well I did. and that's not a good way to work with a sponsor, by the way. So that changed. And then I moved. I moved from California to Arizona, and I got another sponsor there. And the sponsor that I got there, she was one that saw God in everything. And I so needed that, because the God of my understanding was always whoever was standing in front of me. And usually it was him, because I was always waiting for him to get home. I had gotten rid of all my friends. So, you know, it was always him. And it didn't, and I've got to tell you, it wasn't always him, my husband. It was whoever I was in that relationship with. Because, again, it was always, they were addicted to something and it wasn't me. And so my reaction was not good. You know, it was always about trying to get that attention. And so she saw God in everything. And so she started me on my journey on finding my own higher power and finding a God of my understanding. And I'm so, so grateful for that. And so I did. I started working those steps. I will tell you, for me, I did. You know, a lot of people hit their bottom before they come into program. I did not. I hit my bottom while being in program. You know, you talk about being powerless over alcohol, and our lives being unmanageable. When they told me that I could not get my husband sober, that he had to hit his bottom, my thought was, well, let me hit his bottom. Let me help him hit his bottom. You know, and so I started on my journey, you know, during his ins and outs of, well, let's figure out how to make him hit his bottom even faster. You know, and so I was just doing some really, really crazy things. And so it was in program that I finally hit my bottom in realizing that there was nothing I could do. You know, I had tried everything. And I will tell you, one of the things that my sponsor had me do were little exercises, you know, because I kept thinking that, well, you know, I mean, if I shake him, if I yell at him, if I, whatever, you know, if I don't come home, let's play that game. Let's see if I can stay out later than he can, which I never could. She had me doing things like, you know, if you think it's so easy, why don't you try going 24 hours a day without criticizing? If you think it's so easy to stop drinking. And I'll tell you, that was not an easy... I mean, unless I'm sleeping, unless I can't do it. There's always something going on in this brain of mine because it's never just quite right. Or if it is, I need to just make it a little bit better. So I got to do some of those little exercises, and I got to see things like, you know, every time I said, I'm not going to do this again, I'm not going to pick up that phone, I'm not going to go looking for him, I picked up the phone. I kept hitting, you know, redial. I was looking for a friend that would let me trade cars because he knew my car. I wanted to go, you know, do the surveillance thing. You know, and so those were the things that I got to realize, that I was so powerless and that I was as insane. And that was kind of with my step two. I was just as crazy with the disease of alcoholism, and I wasn't drinking. It was my reaction to the things that he was or wasn't doing. So again, I got to walk that path with that second sponsor, and I got to find a God of my own understanding. And I'm really grateful that that it is a God of my understanding, because I didn't come in here with any kind of religious knowledge or anything, and it was really, I got to start from scratch, and I got to find a really, really loving God. And for me, it was those baby steps of just starting to turn a little bit over, you know, try and turn a little bit over. I am not one to jump in a pool. I am one to stick my toe in first. And so so that's what I got to do, was just start a little bit at a time. And lo and behold, I found the evidence of God in my life, even when I didn't think I had a God in my life, you know. And so I'm real grateful for that second sponsor that helped me find that God. I did work my four step, although I will tell you that, you know, when I read the steps in my first few, probably a couple years of meetings, I kept looking at them thinking, okay, well, is he on that step yet? Or yeah, he ought to be doing, well, what's he doing? Blah, 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 you know. It doesn't do any good. And so I got to work on my own four step, and I'll tell you that finding my part in the beginning was so difficult, because again, I was that person that said I looked good on the outside and I believed my own crap. I believed if I looked good enough that I was okay. I believed that if I stood behind the alcoholic and I was just trying to help him, that I was okay, that I was just trying to help. I was the responsible one. What do you mean I did something? What part? You know, and things that I got to find out as far as my part is concerned were things like that treatment center that I took my husband to. Several years later, what ended up happening is I got this bill. I don't even think it was several years later. It was probably within the next year. I got this bill for like $7,000. I'm like, what? What happened to the insurance? Well, I was so impatient that I hadn't waited for the insurance to approve it. I just took them. You know, and I had to own that part, because that was me trying to force those solutions. Now, it wasn't until a few years later that I got to that, because at the time I got the bill, I just got angry. You know, but it's those kinds of things that I got to see that, you know, that's my part in that. I kept forcing solutions. I kept trying to write the story my way. You know, I wanted it to turn out a certain way, and so I would force little things in there, or I would manipulate the situation to come out my way, and unfortunately, it didn't usually turn out my way, which, you know, again, there's a God in my life. So I got to find out my part in a lot of the situations, you know, and I'm really grateful for that, because what it did was, I think for me, it was really about breaking that facade that just because I look good, I wasn't good. I had to start taking a look at the insides. You know, I had to take a look at my actions. And I'll tell you, by the time I got to probably 8 and 9, I think, one of the things that ended up happening, I had a real spiritual awakening when I was listening to my husband on the phone at one time talking about a resentment that he had with me. And I'm thinking, me? You have a resentment with me? What do you mean? You know, and it was like, you know, all the stuff that I had done to help, you know, and so I had to really, really take a look at the things that I did. And it wasn't just with that relationship. So I have to tell you that, you know, I found after coming into Al-Anon, I found that I had way more alcoholics in my life than just him. Again, it was all those relationships. But I also have a brother, or had a brother, who had the disease of alcoholism, and he died at the age of 39 from cirrhosis of the liver. And that was a hard one, because I had been in program. I had been in program for a while when I found out about his alcoholism. He was like 6 years younger than me, and I'd been, you know, out of the house and whatnot when his disease really was full blown, and we lived in different states, and so I didn't know that he was as bad as he was, and so when he was on his deathbed, it was really hard, but it was also such a blessing that I had the people of Al-Anon and AA in my life, because I went from California to Texas and I didn't know the folks there, but guess what? It felt at home. I felt at home, and I got to reach out to people there who met me, who took me to meetings. In reading the big book and listening to some of the AA stories, I'm thinking, oh gosh, you know, all I got to do is see if I can call central office and get them to do a 12-step meeting, or it's 12-step on my brother. And so I tried to do that too. And their question was, does he want us to come? I'm like, well, it doesn't really matter. He's kind of like in the hospital bed. Can you just come anyway? again, it was me trying to manipulate the situations, but I will tell you, it was just such a blessing to have the love and the people of the program in my life at that time, because I could at least share some of that comfort with my mom, who's not in program. You know, my brother did end up dying. He just couldn't quit drinking. You know, he just couldn't quit drinking. So I don't know the new phase of my life. I don't know if my son is or is not an alcoholic, but he's certainly not doing it my way. And the short version is, when I was talking to my sponsor, it was like, okay, he went to bed an angel and he woke up possessed. He's 18, he's going to be 19 this month, and again, he's just not doing it my way. And so I'm so grateful that I have a program and I have a God, and I know that he has a God that I can not do my old behavior of trying to manipulate, although not always am I completely successful, but that I'm not, you know, partaking in my old behavior of trying to run that show. You know, I can love him, and I can turn him over to God, and I can and provide guidance and try to have some boundaries. Now, sometimes those boundaries, on some days they're very light, and other days they're very bold. You know, but that's life. So, anyways, as far as what it's like today is just trying to do daily life with an alcoholic who's sober. My husband did get sober. I sometimes forget to tell people that he did finally get sober. He went in and out for a while. He stayed out. I stayed in that last time when he was singing in the shower. I stayed in for good. But he did finally get sober. But there's a lot of life activities that happen that may or may not have to do with alcoholism, but what this program has done is given me the tools to be able to deal with it. You know, because there are some things, like my husband's had a lot of health issues, and sometimes those health issues look like alcoholism to me. And at times, you know, if I'm not stepped up, if I'm not talking to my sponsor, if I'm not going to my meetings, I can certainly get right back into that old behavior of watching, making sure he's doing what he's supposed to be doing, so that I feel better. And the thing is I feel better when I go to my meetings. I feel better when I make those phone calls. I feel better when I'm here with you, versus sitting at home watching and waiting and trying to do whatever. Last thing I want to say is, you know, again, the best description of my life before Al-Anon was I waited. And after I got into Al-Anon and started working my steps and started, you know, really using a sponsor and reaching out and being of service, is that I have a life of my own today. I don't wait. I don't wait at all. And, in the beginning, my husband would say things like, you were never home. And I would look at him like, well, you weren't home when I was home. And so what we've done is we've got a life where he's got his activities and I have my activities, and you know, sometimes they blend and sometimes they don't, and so you know, we're both very, very busy people, and we have to today we have to make a conscious effort to bring them together, because it's so easy to just go off on his program and my program, and so you know we try to do that today. And again, I just, you know, I have a life which I'm just so grateful for, because I'm not waiting. Happy birthday to the birthday people again. I could have listened to you guys all night, because you guys had some great stuff to share. I absolutely loved what you had to share. Because I too was so afraid of people for forever and a day. I used to say, I just don't like people. And today I know that it wasn't that I didn't like people. I was afraid of people. And I was always afraid of rejection. And today I love you. You know, I love people, and I can fit in without being somebody else today. So thank you for having me. Thank you again, David, and good evening, everybody.